you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
I'm Anna Marie Cox. Welcome to the Churn Pandemic Edition. My day job is talking about politics. And my co-host, Dan Dresner, he has a day job too.
I am Dan Dresner, and my day job is to be a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. I even have a side hustle writing for the Washington Post. But I am also the co-host of The Churn with Anna Marie.
And on this mini season of The Churn, we're talking about pandemic fiction. And I think this book is one that probably came to mind for a lot of people when the current unpleasantness started. Did it come to mind for you?
It certainly did. And I say this, and I don't mean this to be hyperbolic, but this is what we are about to talk about is the single best zombie novel ever written. which admittedly is not a huge genre, and it's slightly disreputable. But this is, you know, we're talking about Max Brooks's World War Z. And having read this now again for the first time in what might be 10 years, I was blown away yet again.
I do think that the micro genre of zombie novel is micro.
Yes, I grant you that. But it does include several distinguished, you know, there are other good zombie novels. Think about Colson Whitehead.
I haven't read Colson Whitehead. So
there's Colson Whitehead Zone One. There's M.R. Carey's The Girl with All the Gifts.
Oh, I like that one a lot, actually.
Yeah, there are a couple of good ones. They're very good. But I do still think this remains the best. And what is striking and terrifying about this book, at least for me, was that even though it was written 15 years ago, it was disturbing the degree to which reading this, how much particularly the first third of the book resonated.
Yeah. Do you want to give us the plot summary and then maybe we can do general thoughts and then maybe, I don't know, if we feel like it, get into specifics.
We could. So I'll be happy to provide the plot, which is a little harder to do with this than with, let's say, Chuck Wendig's The Wanderers. It's a shorter book, but nonetheless, plot is sort of hard to describe. The framing device of Brooks's novel is that it's an after-action report by a UN investigator after the zombie war, which implies, by the way, that just, you know, spoiler alert, as it turns out, the humans won. See if this sounds familiar. The start of the zombie virus begins in China, with the after effects of displacement due to the construction of the Three Gorges Dam. China, once they discover what is going on, covers it up initially, and indeed acts in a very bellicose manner towards its close neighbors, including, most importantly, Taiwan. Despite this effort to cover things up, travel just inevitably leaves this or renders this a global phenomenon. It inevitably does go global. It is referred to as African rabies, you know, much like efforts to call the current thing we are dealing with the Wuhan flu. A few states do react early enough to preserve a normal way of life, as it were. Israel is the first state to announce that they are actually dealing with zombies. One of the better vignettes is that North Korea goes completely underground and is never heard from again. Nonetheless, I'll see if this also sounds familiar. All of the great powers handle this very, very badly. There is a civil war in China that eventually breaks out. In Russia, there is something that is called the decimation, which, as it turns out in this case, literally means the killing of one of every 10 Russians in response to the crisis. And in the United States, well, oh dear, you see an initial downplaying of the threat. Then there is a fake vaccine that is announced called Phalanx that ostensibly puts the population at ease. There is an administration in power that wants to do the very least to make it seem like they have done a lot. And then, nonetheless, as the problem continues to get worse, bureaucracies try to combat the undead with traditional standard operating procedures, leading to a disastrous Battle of Yonkers that closes out the first third of the book. Eventually, all of the states involved managed to develop both new strategies and new tactics to halt the spread of the undead and eventually defeat them. And, you know, the book sort of hopscotches across the globe, showing some interesting winners and losers. One of the surprising winners in the zombie war is Cuba, because, among other things, they deal with a sudden influx of, I believe they call them Norte Cubanos, or people coming from Florida, and eventually Cuba winds up becoming a democracy. The losers, it would be safe to say, Russia doesn't do terribly well. Argentina sort of disappears. And there are other challenges, interesting challenges along the way. There's an exchange of nuclear weapons at one point. And then there are interesting sort of non-zombie threats that emerge. Character, you know, a category of actors called Quislings that are essentially humans that act like they're zombies, or Ferals, who are children left abandoned in the zombie sort of infested area and in some ways are very much like animals. And indeed, there are additional shifts in the climate.
And I would say that the thing that does thread all of these things together is kind of a search for best practices. I mean, in some ways, it's kind of a hilariously consistent book when you
Yes.
step back, because the author is always looking for what worked the best and what were the things that people could build on. And it turns out that there's a lot of stuff that I know you, as the zombie apocalypse optimist, probably feels good about. It is ultimately an incredibly optimistic book.
It is. So the last half of the book is essentially how the remaining governments essentially figure out how to consolidate the human run areas and then decide to go on the offensive and essentially reclaim their territories. And it's very clear, it's from page one of the book, that there are significant costs to all this. But nonetheless, what makes this an unusual book within the zombie genre, or an unusual narrative within the zombie genre, is that it is human beings that wind up being able to adapt to these circumstances and not the undead. And so in that respect, it is a ridiculously optimistic book, even though Brooks is uncompromising in describing the costs to individuals and to societies of, you know, billions lost to a war of the undead. But in some ways, that's what makes, I think for me, the book is even more optimistic precisely because it acknowledges the costs. And despite that, says, nonetheless, you know, human ingenuity can triumph. And even though it's a novel, it's really a sort of pastiche of short stories, mm-hmm. You know, told from different people. And the character of the narrator isn't that present. But you're right that the one way in which you do sort of feel that character, even though he's never named, is the degree to which he just seems to be searching for what is it that worked, who borrowed from whom. So like there's the tactic that the U.S. Army winds up developing comes initially from an Indian general. And there are, you know, other tactics that emerge that other, and the South African Redeker plan winds up essentially being adopted by almost every other country as their solution for how to deal with this. And so in that sense, it was a fascinating book of watching how an apocalypse can hit humanity and then how humanity can recover from that. And I like that second part of it.
You mentioned the first third of the book is, in this particular unpleasant time, the part that can be gut-wrenching. It's also the part that's the most, it's when the zombie apocalypse becomes clear. So it's,
right.
You know, it's sort of part one is the emergence and the most terrifying. Part two is like the destruction. And some very gross battles and whatnot. And then part three is sort of the turn when things get better. But my quote is from part one, and it is, "Most people don't believe something can happen until it already has. That's not stupidity or weakness. That's just human nature."
Yes, I underline that as well. That line is very interesting because, as our listeners are probably aware, there is a movie version of World War Z. And without casting aspersions on the movie, the great thing about that movie, the best thing I can say about that movie, is that you can watch that movie and then read the book, because there is very little overlap between those two things. But one of the few areas of overlap is, in fact, that sentence, which is something that stands out.
But it is like, I mean, obviously, like, that's something that I think about a lot today. I mean, people just don't believe. And one of the pleasures of genre fiction has, to me, always been the idea, this is actually really weird, maybe, but it is something I enjoy about genre fiction, which is that if something bizarre happens in the world, I'm going to be more ready to believe it than other people. That's what I've always told myself. Like,
no, and I think the other appealing thing about genre fiction is that it allows you to talk about things that if you actually talk about in the real world become genuinely horrifying. The advantage of thinking about it in a genre way is that it gives you what that necessary psychological area of remove to think about these things. And so what was it, for me reading this again, because I read the book very closely when I was writing Theories of International Politics and Zombies, but reading this again now, I had to put the book down after the first 100 pages because I was really rattled by the strong parallels, particularly in the United States, of how the government wanted to do as little as humanly possible, how bureaucracies were completely unprepared for coping with this. It was too real for me.
Yeah, and I guess that quote is obviously representative because one of the things that you have to lift, you know, the weight of disbelief, is that this is a zombie apocalypse, right? And it is fun. It's always fun to imagine how would people deal with that thing that is unimaginable. And it turns out it doesn't have to be zombies. It can be just a hyper contagious novel coronavirus.
Right.
It elicits the same kinds of denial, you know? I mean, and that's what makes this section so terrifying, you know, and familiar, is that they're just like, all these governments are just as incapable of dealing with zombies as they were with the coronavirus. It's actually kind of a weird backwards comparison.
Right. No, I agree. And to be fair, I will say the capacious version of that quote is to say, it's not just governments, it's all of us. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know about you. You know, I was paying attention to the coronavirus. You know, I wrote about it in January, and then I really started paying attention in February. And, you know, I thought this was going to be a thing. And yet, even though I was worried about it, and I did a few things like, you know, buy a few extra provisions at Costco and so forth, it's still like the sort of exponential increase still caught me by surprise. So it's one thing to sort of think about it at an intellectual level, and then it's another thing to process it and actually realize how you need to change your behavior. And so even I think people who were paying attention to it, the nature of the sort of exponential change, which is also the way things sort of play out in World War Z, I think as well, is still shocking that it's hard for human beings to adjust initially.
Yeah, I think it's maybe a subtlety of the book that it's just as much the exponential nature of the zombie apocalypse that is shocking and mm-hmm. difficult to deal with as it is the fact that it is the rise of the
living
undead.
Yeah.
It's the fact that they are able to create more undead with each and every, you know, successful engagement. But do you want to get to your quote?
So my quote is actually from the second half of the book. It says, ignorance was the enemy. Lies and superstition, misinformation, disinformation, sometimes no information at all. Ignorance killed billions of people. Ignorance caused the zombie war. And it was the description of a sort of loosely radio-free Earth, I think is what it was called, a sort of network of broadcasts that would actually transmit, among other things, best practices, but also attempt to puncture myths or conspiracy theories about, you know, what was going on in terms of the living dead. And it actually ties into something else that appears elsewhere in the book, that pointing out that one of the reasons, I think, why there were so many myths and rumors about this was you had these Quisling types that essentially acted like zombies. And so you would think of them as zombies, and yet you could actually take them down because they were physiologically still human beings. You could kill them with a hard shot, and therefore it would work. And so it meant that data is always messy when you're dealing with a pandemic. and so, you know, it explains why in the book, not everyone necessarily believes what's going to happen. But I also think it explains why even now we're still debating fiercely about, you know, things like case fatality ratios or whether how easily the disease can be spread. And, you know, even when you're dealing with hard numbers like numbers of infection, it's potentially deceptive because it also depends on a function of how often are you know, how many tests are going on and so forth. So what was perhaps excessively optimistic in the book, which is weird to say, is that they were describing a successful way of sort of to push back against misinformation. And what I kept thinking is, I wish that was true now.
I actually literally just wrote down when you talked about Radio Free Earth, we are seeing right now, the results of having a, not just, I guess, bifurcated media, but shattered media and trust in institutions. I'm excited to talk to Max Brooks about the book, in part because I think he did not anticipate the degree to which people would not trust either media or most institutions. There is a climactic, and I always want to call it the Independence Day speech, but it's the St. Crispin's Day speech, really, right?
Yes.
From the president, who rallies not just the nation, but the world to, you know, take back humanity and take back the earth. And trying to imagine that speech today, I mean, I guess, would Angela Merkel give it? Like,
I think she's the only one left. It would be... It's hard to envision Trump doing it. Although, of course, we know as we were speaking, Trump actually, I assume you saw that tweet of Trump's in which he tries to, someone has him giving that Independence Day speech.
Yes, he did. Someone superimposed his head onto the Bill Pullman Independence Day speech. But I think that's as close as he's going to get.
And exactly.
I, like I said, I'm just going to really enjoy hearing what he thinks about that and how this fictional version of worst case scenario, what would happen if he had managed to work that little wrinkle in.
It's true. No, and the other quote that sort of, I think, still resonates today, and it's where he was pessimistic, is in the first part of the book where a CIA official explains that, in fact, they did, you know, develop a plan to deal with the undead, that they had sufficient intel to believe that this was a real thing. The Israelis had informed them. They had developed a multi-phase plan to deal with it. And when asked why they didn't actually do it, he explains phase two required a massive national undertaking, the likes of which hadn't been seen since the darkest days of the Second World War. That kind of effort requires Herculean amounts of both national treasure and national support, both of which by that point were non-existent.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a wee bit disturbing to read in the middle of a pandemic. The one thing I would say, you're right that there are ways in which Brooks might be overly optimistic. But I think one of the things I genuinely love about the book is precisely because it sort of hopscotches from different place to different place. And because it's just really a sort of Studs Terkel kind of, you know, novel of very small vignettes, is that those vignettes are very different. And so there are stories that or there are portions of it that end badly. Okay, so Anna Marie, let me ask you, obviously there are multiple vignettes in this book, and this is, I think, for both of us, the second time we've read it. Which vignette did you like the most? Which vignette, you know, scared you the most of all of these?
Huh. So the vignette that stood out to me the most is actually a positive one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one that I literally did not recall at all from my first reading. And it is this sort of two-hander of the Japanese teenager who was a video game obsessive
yes.
in his previous life.
Yes.
All data. He lived on the interwebs. And his elder, a blind, older Japanese fellow who
was blinded by the Hiroshima blast, I believe.
Blinded by the Hiroshima blast and convinced of his own worthlessness for decades.
Right.
Who becomes a kind of samurai zombie killer, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's, yes, I think that's a safe description of what he becomes. Yeah.
They invent apparently a whole new martial art of zombie battle.
Mm-hmm.
And the old man has a spiritual take on it, which I won't try to replicate because I think it's actually pretty subtle and interesting. Although his young companion is kind of like, oh, I don't care about the spiritual shit. I just think he's really cool. But he's also gained a lot of wisdom, this former video game dude.
Right.
So I loved that. I loved the idea of these two people finding their purpose.
Yeah.
In a crisis. Cause I think that does happen.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And then as far as things that will haunt me, I guess it says something about me, I'm not sure what, that stuff was harder for me to read and harder for me to retain. One of the things that stuck with me is the Radio Free Earth suicides, though.
Yeah.
Which is the fact that this very positive force, Radio Free Earth, which is integral to humanity's survival, part of what they did was just monitor the broadcast from everywhere. And the story goes that those that were monitoring the broadcast from the countries and areas that were overrun couldn't live with what they heard.
Yeah, which is entirely believable. There's a surprising amount in this book. I hadn't thought about it until you just said this, but there is a surprising amount in this book on suicide. It recurs through a lot of the description. The two stories that stood out, the first, I wouldn't describe this as upbeat exactly, but it is the story that easily makes me laugh the most, is the sort of vignette about what happens to North Korea, right. Which is that
you're such a nerd.
North Korea. I know. But I will say this. The first time I read it, it was the thing that stood out because I thought as an IR, international relations person, yeah, that's believable, which in some ways, by the way, does kind of mirror what's happening a little bit now. But like in the book, North Korea simply, the North Korean population just disappears. Essentially, they all go underground and no one knows what has happened to them. No one has gone into North Korea because there are still automated defenses. And we just never know what happens. And that was amusing. But what I had forgotten about and rereading this time was very disturbing, was the story of one family that essentially had planned to head north because in the book, as it turns out.
Oh, I know it. Yes. Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. In the book, as it turns out, one of the rules about the zombies is that if you're in the cold, you actually are relatively safe because the zombies do freeze during the winter, although they thaw out in the spring and will then attack. And it's this long description from this woman who was clearly a child when this started, of a family that had actually prepared in advance, was worried about this, and then caravans up north. Basically, it's a microcosm of even the most prepared people will screw up. They will run out of resources, and what looks initially like a viable society, civil society, starts to break down. For me, it was the most depressing part of the book, and it ends with a very chilling way in which the family decides to stay alive, in which
it's cold. There's not a lot of food. Just, you know, it's not exactly a revelatory, like, it's not much of a twist, but we will resist spoiling it entirely. I do want to not spoil something, but say out loud what I appreciated, which is the canine corps.
Yes.
Having a really big role in defeating the zombies. And there is such a wonderful little twist. Oh, and my dog is warning me. Don't spoil it. Don't spoil it, Mom. So I will not spoil it, but animal lovers will have a particular section to enjoy. The only thing I'd like to say before we leave is maybe circle back to the St. Crispin's Day speech moment, which is, it is true that there have been such moments in history. I don't want to call it unrealistic, but it is a little depressing because it kind
really,
of posits, it posits that the way that humanity comes back hinges upon like a great man kind of thing. Like, I don't know. There's a part of me that wants to believe that humanity would not need a single great leader to rally around.
So it's interesting, actually, because in some ways that part is it's the part that in some ways is slightly a different tone from the rest of the book, because the thing about most of this book is that you're really looking at things from the sort of either grunt eyes perspective, or if they're talking to people that were in charge, they were failed people in charge, usually in the past. And so really it was almost just sort of descriptions at the sort of grunt level or at the operator level, to use an IR term. Whereas that part, what is, by the way, clearly Colin Powell, or a Colin Powell stand-in.
Oh, really? I was going to ask who that was.
Oh, yeah. No. It's the president is clearly Colin Powell and the vice president is clearly Howard Dean. Because,
really?
Oh, yeah. Yes. No, I'm very. So we will ask Max these questions, I think. But
the
yes,
wacko.
I'm quite sure.
I guess
about
it makes
this.
Sense now. Okay. I'm putting it together.
Yeah. Because also there's a reference to the president talking, the president. Is formerly of the military and has family in Jamaica. And that is clearly
Powell. And also the two different colors, the president and is black in the,
yeah.
Okay. So, you know, it's funny because I guess the vice president character seemed conservative to me.
Yes. But that said, you're right that that was the one moment where it does, it reads a little bit like Independence Day, mm-hmm. Rather than anything else. And yet I can't be that upset with it because, and this is a problem as a political scientist, one of the things that you always wind up becoming very wary of is what I would refer to as the great speech theory of mm-hmm. you know, politics, which is a lot of political narratives, most of Aaron Sorkin stuff, you know, you name it, always has this sort of big political speech that is somehow supposed to change everyone's mind. And it does play out a little bit like that in the book. But I will say the one grace note, I think, is that there was a translator who describes this portion and sort of makes it seem like this is also sort of inexorably what humans were going to have to do, that mere survival was not going to be enough. There had to be some sort of vision of the future that was a positive one. And I think that that is true of the way that we're hardwired, that it's not enough just for us to be able to survive. We also have to be able to see a world that can be a better one than the one we live in now.
I think that's a great place to take a break.
Okay.
So let's take a break and we'll be right back with Max Brooks himself.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome back to The Churn. We are very happy to have with us Max Brooks, the author of the finest zombie novel ever written, World War Z, as well as the Zombie Survival Guide. And we're looking forward to a conversation about what this book tells us about the current unpleasantness.
Dan is a huge fan of the book. I am as well. I think it might be the first zombie novel I ever read. It's a micro genre of sorts. did you set out to write something optimistic?
Always.
Was it a conscious decision to go against the normal misanthropic genre?
I never make a conscious decision to go against anything. I always write for me. I never write for a marketplace. I never write for a genre. I never write for anybody but myself because I'm the only person that I trust. If I understood the marketplace better, I wouldn't have been fired off Saturday Night Live. So I just write what I want to read. And the reason that I keep it optimistic is because we don't have a choice. Because I feel that people who write pessimistic punishment stories really do feel like the world is a safe place and we can have sort of a cheap pornographic thrill knowing that it's really a safe thing. Mm. I've traveled the world. I've worked around the world. I've seen the dark side of humanity. I know what we're capable of. Especially in the United States of America, the only thing that holds us together is our ideals. We are a patchwork. And if we're going to go forward and hang together, the only way we can is with these shared ideals, and they need to be reinforced in art. So I have to be optimistic because the other option is death.
I don't know if you saw this, but Senator Ted Cruz tweeted about World War Z, I think a week or two ago. Not the novel, but the movie version, but mentioned the book that basically he was upset that the Chinese origins of the zombie virus or the zombie plague are mentioned in the book rather prominently, but were not in the film version. And he was clearly upset about that. arguing that the reason that was done was so that the movie could play in China and so on and so forth. I guess my question is, are you upset about that?
No, you can't be upset about something that you take for granted, which is when you're up and coming and you sell the movie rights to your first book, you don't have the right to whine. It's that simple. You either sell the movie rights and you accept that what is going to be on the screen is probably not what is going to be on the page, but more people will be reading your book otherwise, which is why we do this as authors. If you don't want to do that, if you want complete control, if you want your ego shielded and your feelings unhurt, then don't take the risk. I forgot that over the course of the process of the movie being made. And then two men, Frank Darabont and Stephen King, smacked some sense into me. Oh. And Frank Darabont, who created the show Walking Dead and was then fired off of it, reminded me very clearly that there is no greater revenge than being a novelist, because then you get your story pure in its original form, as opposed to being a screenwriter, where your work is utterly eviscerated and your name's still on it, and people think that's the story you were trying to tell. Then Stephen King followed up by reminding me that any novelist sells the book in order to bring a second life to that book. And so basically, I have no right to complain.
This gives rise to another question that I have, which was rereading this again, the thing I was struck by this time, which I don't think I had picked up the first time I read it, was the sort of, for lack of a way of putting it, the shadow that suicide plays in almost the entire novel, where a lot of your characters are forced to do truly horrific or appalling things that are necessary for the species to survive. And the degree to which some of these characters then wind up choosing to end their own lives, or in some ways, in many cases, you imply that they only had so much life to give for the cause and then sort of died of their own volition. How much did you do much research into what would cause suicide or sort of post-traumatic stress disorder and those kinds of issues?
Oh, yeah. You know me, and you know that for every hour I spend writing, I do between 10 and 100 hours researching. You know, every individual topic that could be in books, that could be talking to the actual experts. You know, for every fake expert I interview in the book, I had to interview at least one or two real experts per character. The notion of giving up is very common, particularly in societies that believe they are being defeated. The best example of it on the flip side is Great Britain in World War II, where suicides plummeted because Churchill made them believe that they could win, and that they were part of something bigger than themselves. You know, contrast that with Hitler's henchmen in the last days of the Reich, who were just offing themselves like there was no tomorrow. The best example of that is the movie Downfall. I don't know if you two have ever seen that one.
I've only seen the meme of it, unfortunately, oh, which is, God. I probably need to see the whole book.
the whole scene, yes. In the bunker when General Krebs just says, oh, he just shrugs and goes, I'm not going anywhere, and then just puts a gun in his mouth. I mean, that's very common.
The solution may not be as easy as a simple turn, because I think you're right that when we're presented with catastrophic possibilities, it is perhaps an evolutionary, you know, sort of adaptation that we think the worst will happen, right? And sometimes not such an evolutionary advantageous, you know, way, we slide all the way down to despair and to suicidal despair. But we get bucked up too, right? I mean, I've been thinking a lot about that in this environment, the current unpleasantness, of course. And there have been accounts of depression going up. I know alcohol sales are way up. But at the same time, you know, my neighborhood has been remarkably connected. Like, I live in a downtown neighborhood that's a bunch of apartments, you know. We don't have a reason to talk to each other very often, but we suddenly do, and people are talking to each other. And then there's also the connection that we've made by staying home for each other. You know, I think that you have that in the book as well, but maybe it has to come after Darkness.
Well, I have a whole chapter in there about the suicides and about, or people just not waking up, going to bed, just not waking up. I mean, that's That part is directly taken from the book that inspired World War Z, which is Fed Circle's The Good War, and the stories of a POW and the POWs who would just die, opposed to the ones who decided I would live. That kind of depression. I tried very hard to talk about the psychological war, the idea that you have to give people a reason. You cannot let them slide into despair. You also cannot let them believe they're alone.
I guess I was sort of trying to get to how that darkness is somewhat inevitable, and you have to go through it to get to the other side of it. And one of the delicious things about this book is the way it uses this, you know, catastrophe, like many catastrophes, it turns society on its head a bit in this vision, which is, you know, you have what I guess we'll call essential workers, including people who are farmers, right, become some of the most influential and important people in this next society, right? Like,
oh, yeah.
You get to turn all of that upside down.
Well, and that goes directly to the Second World War, where every job was essential. And our government went out of its way to get Hollywood to make movies about people doing jobs that are not glamorous, but their job is important. No matter what you do, whether it's mining coal or whether it is being the air raid warden, it is an important job. I mean, that's in A Wonderful Life. George Bailey can't go to war because of his ear, but he does every other little job. He makes a difference. Because our government understood everybody has to feel that they're doing something, they're making a contribution. And if you feel like your actions are part of something bigger and you're moving that bigger whole forward just by your teeny little job, that is incredibly empowering.
One question I have is, as you say, you wrote this in the sort of the wake of the SARS epidemic in the early mid-2000s. It would be safe to say that the current pandemic is more widespread and has caused much more global response to it. I'm sort of curious, in the ways in which you've observed this, is there any difference in your mind? I guess, is there anything in terms of watching how we've responded that if you were to go back and rewrite World War Z or were to write a follow-up to it, is there something new that you've seen that you'd think you'd want to add?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's some things I'm shocked about how right they are. Like, you know, Israel, I get, but I didn't realize the ultra-Orthodox were going to try to fuck it up as badly as they did in World War Z. I thought, oh, my God, this is life imitating art. I didn't realize that we would be in such a bad place as I wrote about, many of these countries. But the one thing that I got spectacularly wrong is Taiwan.
Hmm.
Because in my book, by this point, Taiwan has gotten closer and closer to China. Because when I wrote it, they were on good terms. They were starting to integrate. That was before relations really started to cool. But since writing the book, they have. And while we are all bending over backwards to praise China, and because being good liberals, we have this knee-jerk reaction that anything Donald Trump says against China, we then feel we have to say something for China. But the truth is, we're all praising the wrong China. We should be praising the Republic of China, because they have done an absolutely heroic job of keeping this virus at bay. And they are a functioning democracy. And they absolutely kick this red Chinese notion that only authoritarianism is the best way to solve a crisis. They kick that right in the balls because they prove that you can be a functioning democracy with an open press and still manage a disaster. Because that's a big problem that we're up against right now. We're not just up against this virus. We're up against a historical narrative that China is trying to push, which is democracies are silly and messy and they get people killed. If you would just all have a capitalist authoritarian system where you still get money and cars and cool stuff, but you just don't get a vote and let the leaders manage you, you'll be okay because we got this. And that's what China's trying to push, and we all know that. Taiwan is saying, no, here is a giant Kuomintang middle finger in your face.
Yes, and I will add that one of the more disturbing elements, I think, of the Trump administration's response, which is, you're right, they do praise Taiwan, but sometimes they're asked why, you know, is South Korea doing well? And, you know, I think twice at least there have been Trump officials who somehow conflate an Asian country as authoritarian. Which is not the way that you should think of either South Korea or Taiwan.
You know, there is one part of the human reaction to the, you know, zombie hordes that seems very necessary and winds up being positive, but is still pretty chilling, which is the Rydecker plan. I wonder where your historical parallel for that is, because it's a pretty dark part of the book. It doesn't get actually written about that. It's referred to a lot, but the difficulty, the moral difficulty of having to shut away some fellow humans in order for the most to survive.
Oh, you're talking about the Rydecker plan?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's easy. I mean, the Rydecker plan is a combination of two different facts. The Rydecker plan came from when I was a kid in seventh grade watching a documentary about apartheid South Africa and about how every South African kid is taught to shoot from, I don't know, the age of 12. The idea that the apartheid Afrikaners would be living on the edge of Armageddon every minute of every day and would be ready for a Mau Mau-style rebellion in their country. So that kind of armed paranoia that wasn't a stretch of the imagination. There it was. That's number one. But combine that with the Soviet withdrawal behind the Ural Mountains, the idea that an entire nation could just pick up all of its essential war production and all of its essential workers and move to a safe zone and then leave the unessentials behind as bait for the enemy. Well, I didn't make that up. That was already done.
But every nation adopts a version of it. Is that right?
Yes. Every nation adapts some version of it in some way as a last ditch effort. And I emphasize last ditch because since the book came out, especially in the 08 recession, there were sort of some arch conservatives that were against the bailout, saying that we needed an economic Rydecker plan to just let these companies die, to which I was saying, no, don't turn my book into a how-to like they did with Michael Lewis turning Liar's Poker into a how-to cheat.
Give me back my metaphor.
Well, yeah. I was going to ask about the plan and about sort of the real life part of it, which is that, yes, I know humans do that to each other. But it was interesting to me to have it have such a prominent, you know, place in the plot of the book, because we're so used to, I think, especially as Americans and even in zombie movies, there's a lot of like no man left behind stuff, right? Like you always figure out the way to get the last person in the door of the bunker. And in this book, like you're just pretty straight up, like there are going to be some people that you shut the door on.
That's not made up. I mean, even in the United States, even if you look at all our nuclear war plans, there's just something called triage. If you look at every army hospital in every war, there's something called triage. There are the people that you simply cannot, I don't want to say waste, but you simply cannot expend resources on people that you will not be able to save. Every mega disaster plan that's ever been written has had to take that into account. And it's horrible and it's brutal. And it's exactly why anyone with a conscience works damn hard to make sure that plan is never enacted. But that plan is always there.
It is interesting to see that I think the parallel again between your book and what we're seeing now is that the societies that have coped better with this relative to others are the ones, partially it's democracies, but it's also essentially countries that perceive an existential threat out there, whether it's South Korea in the case of North Korea or Taiwan in the case of China or Israel in the case of its region.
No, you're right. But that's a good point, is that I, in World War Z, as in this real pandemic, I present the theory that countries that are aware of their mortality respond mm-hmm. better.
I have a question, because you mentioned what a world traveler you are, how much you've seen, and you've seen some dark things. And you've also talked a lot about the research you've done and the experts you've talked to. And so I know the book is based in rigorous research that's sort of archival or expert based. But what in the book is based on your personal experience?
Oh, well, I mean, a lot of it is. The experience, well, Africa, you know, I've been there. I worked for the BBC when I was in Africa. I worked for BBC in the UK. I've gone to graduate school in Prague. I've been to many of the countries that I write about, and I can tell you exactly how it is. I was in Russia in 1994, and while everyone else in America was celebrating, all I saw was a defeated nation waiting for a Marshall Plan, and it wasn't happening.
I was in Ukraine in 1994.
Yeah. So we've seen it. And so at the end, when I have my Russian character say, this was way before Putin rose, when my Russian character says, we're strong again, we're feared again, and that means we're safe again because we finally have a Caesar. I saw that hunger amidst the chaos of Russia when I was there. And it didn't take a PhD to see the storm clouds.
Do you feel optimistic about where we're headed right now?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because we're Americans. And I don't mean that in some sort of bravado, but we have to be forward thinking. We have to be optimistic. We have to have a better vision for the future. And then we have to work for it, because otherwise there is no point.
I think that one of the benefits of a tragedy or a catastrophe of the kind of thing we're going through, I guess crisis is another word, is that we do see our weaknesses, right? And the weaknesses of our country have been unveiled, brought to light. They were always there. But, you know, the inequalities of gig workers, right? The number of Black and brown people who make our country function, but have some of the worst healthcare and worst, you know, healthcare outcomes of anyone. And I can't forget those as we're talking up how wonderful we are.
What I hope we take from this is at least a basic respect of science and institutions that we didn't have before, because I do believe that this plague came along, could only have come along at this time. Because now that most, even America's elderly, grew up in a time when vaccinations were commonplace, we've lost our gut memory, our innate fear of microbes and of science and scientists, because you take it for granted. Hopefully that will at least restore a little bit of it, I'm hoping. But, you know, we'll see. It's all about what we learn from this. It's never about something bad happening to you. It's all about what you learn from it and how you move forward. And, you know, we'll see. Is this when this virus passes, are we going to be 1919 or are we going to be 1945?
And this ties back into the entire zombie genre, which is what's always interesting about the zombie genre. It's not really the zombies. It's how do human beings react to them?
Always. Oh, and that's why specifically why I make my zombies so weak and so slow, because they need to be stoppable. It's not interesting if they're fast. If they're fast, first of all, number one, if they're fast, that trips the alarm bells, and then we respond the same way we responded to Ebola. Ebola is a fast zombie. But also, if you make your zombies too indestructible or your threat too indestructible, then you need a magic bullet. Then you need the Fresh Prince and the Fly developing a computer virus to knock out the aliens. It's got to be something that we could do, but we're not doing. And then that is a mirror for our own foibles.
Wow, I hope your analysis like applies to this. You know, I hope it's not going to come down to Fresh Prince and the Fly inventing a vaccine. I hope it's just doctors that do it.
But you know, I grew up with another plague called AIDS. And we went from, and I based a lot of my social responses to zombies in my books from that plague, where you go from denial to panic, and then you get your act together. And we did. You know, AIDS, we never cured it. There's no vaccine. There's no cure. We stopped AIDS with social education, with C. Everett Koop mailing out a pamphlet to every single American household saying understanding AIDS. Just simple education. And the whole country changed. You want to talk about a country moving forward? We went from free love to safe sex. And let me tell you, I did my part in high school by not getting laid.
I think we have a good place to end. Or unless yeah. I think we should not get any further into at least that line of yeah. questioning. Is there anything like you want to add, Dan?
The last question I would ask is the one we asked Chuck Wendig as well, which is, how are you doing in this time?
I've been phenomenally lucky. I'm lucky that nobody, you know, my dad's okay. My mother-in-law, who's had lung cancer twice, she's okay. I'm lucky that I got a house with a little patch of dirt that I can grow vegetables so I don't have to go to the grocery store. I'm lucky that my son is 15. He's old enough to be able to homeschool himself, so I don't have to take time out from my life to walk him through. He's gone from a taker to a giver. I'm in a very lucky position, and I'm very grateful.
That is definitely a good way to end this.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Max.